Hi, babe.
Hi.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Rebel Mama Hotline. In this episode, we continue our Rebel Mama Health Kick in partnership with the Women's Health Collective of Canada. The team at WHCC has graciously given us access to some of their top researchers who are working hard behind the scenes to bring women's health research out of the shadows so we can all access better care.
Today, we'll be speaking to Dr. Colleen Norris, who is a resident expert on heart health, specifically women's heart health. If you're wondering why this conversation is relevant or how this research affects you, here are some stats that highlight just how important it is that you tune into this chat.
According to a study conducted by the Heart and Stroke Foundation in 2018, we now know that heart disease is the leading cause of premature death for women in Canada. Early heart attack signs were missed in 78% of women. Every 20 minutes, a woman in Canada dies from heart disease. 5 times as many women die from heart disease as breast cancer. 2/3 of heart disease clinical research focuses on men. And women who have a heart attack are more likely to die or suffer a second heart attack compared to men. Clearly, we are only just beginning to understand women's heart health, and today's guest has a lot to do with the strides that we've made. We can't wait to pick Dr. Colleen Norris's brain about all of this, but before we do, let's break for a quick commercial from our sponsors.
This episode of the Rebel Mama Hotline was brought to you by Women's Health Collective Canada. WHCC was created by 3 of Canada's leading women's health and hospital foundations to break the barriers holding us back from providing women with the knowledge and care they deserve. Through intentional collaboration, WHCC brings resources, fundraising, and some of the brightest minds in science and healthcare together to address the wider gaps we can't tackle on our own. Learn more about who they are and what they do at whcc.ca.
Welcome back, everyone. It's time to chat with Dr. Norris, but first, a quick intro. Dr. Colleen Norris is the Caverzin Chair in Mature Women's Health Research at Alberta's Lewis Hole Hospital for Women. She's particularly interested in mature women's health research that includes the context of their stage in life. Dr. Norris is a professor and associate dean of research with the Faculty of Nursing and holds appointments with the Division of Cardiology, the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology and Medicine, and the School of Public Health. She is the past chair of the Canadian Women's Heart Health Alliance Health Policy and Services Working Group. Dr. Norris is internationally recognized for her leadership in sex and gender science and in developing and sharing evidence-informed strategies to transform clinical practice and impact public policy related to women's health. Welcome to the Rebel Mama Hotline, Dr. Norris.
Thank you for being here and for the incredible work you've been doing to advance women's heart health research. We appreciate it. We'd like to start with a practical question. When we imagine a heart attack, we have a pretty clear image in our head. Someone grabs their left arm or their chest and falls to the ground. But that someone is typically a man. Can you tell us how women's heart and stroke symptoms and presentations differ from those of men's? Like, what are we looking for?
So that's a really incredibly complex question. And the reason it is because it, when you talk about, you know, the elephant sitting on your heart or what we see on television, mm-hmm. we also see people who are out of shape or they're smokers or they have high blood pressure, you know, all the risk factors that we've all heard all our life. Bad for heart disease. The same applies for women, but the picture of the woman who's having heart health issues today fit. Some of them were high-level athletes. They don't smoke. They don't have hypertension. And so everyone's really miffed by it when they say, I have this incredible chest discomfort is one of the things, or the shoulder pain. The symptoms, they will say something about their chest, like discomfort, or it's just aching, or it almost feels like heartburn. But
I think I've had that before. Yeah. Like, it's like a chest pain. I've had it like once recently, and I totally got scared about it.
Well, it's like good it, that you're
would it
paying
feel like
attention.
A tightness? Weight, like a tightness.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So it's good you're paying attention. But the thing is that along with it, women also experiencing three or four other symptoms that men might experience or not. So you might get nausea and vomiting at the same time, right? So it's not just the chest pain. You say, geez, I feel like I'm going to throw up. Or they're all happening together. Neck and back pain, shoulder pain. The interesting thing about the shoulder pain is that I remember my mom telling me I had the most interesting shoulder pain last night. It was like the pain was every time my heart beat.
Oh my God. Kind of
think, okay. Oh, wow. Okay. You know, like, so it isn't just, you know, oh, I have achy shoulders kind of thing, but it's that they're all happening together. And the other one that really throws people, because they are fit and they're saying, I'm really short of breath. Mm. And there was a study done like 15 years ago where, McSweeney in the state, she asked women who'd had heart attacks symptoms prior to it. And one of the things that they all noted, or 70% of them noted, which really blew me away, was incredible fatigue the month before it happened. And so we're talking about not just I'm tired all the time. We're all tired all the time. It was like, I have to sit down to make this bed. Like, so things that you normally do, you just say, God, I'm exhausted. Mm. So the whole idea of us advocating for women's heart health is to get those messages out there. So don't deny them and don't like start saying, I need to do something about that.
And I feel like it's hard for women sometimes to acknowledge those things because we are so busy and we're often tired and we're doing so many things. So for you to stop and be like, I mean, I didn't disregard it, but I was like, oh, this chest pain, I probably just like need some rest or I need to chill out or something. But it's not, what I'm saying is sometimes you don't even make the time to stop and think about it because you have all these things going on. Yeah. And you just attribute it to, oh, well, whatever. I'm a busy mom. I'm a busy woman and I'm fine. So
yeah, just absolutely. And the thing is that there are specific risk factors for women that we now know that we didn't know even 5 years ago. Things like if you had high blood pressure in your pregnancy, if you had, I'm just going to read them off because recurrent.
Well, that was our next question. What are the causes?
Well, recurrent, women who have what I'm going to describe, which is an interesting list, they just have to recognize that they're at higher risk so that when they do feel that chest pain, they say, you know what, I'm going to get it checked with my doctor because I know that if I had a preterm delivery is one of the risk factors for earlier heart disease in women, small for gestational age babies, high blood pressures, gestational diabetes. We used to think that if you got diabetes while you were pregnant, when you had the baby,
it went away.
You're good to go.
Yeah,
right?
Gone diabetes with the baby. Diabetes out.
Yeah.
But that it actually, there's something going on with your vessels while that's occurring. Diabetes is rough on your vascular system. And so now we're finding that the women who had gestational diabetes that don't manage that risk end up showing up with heart disease like 10 years earlier than any other woman.
Wow.
And what's really fascinating about this is, so I'm on the Canadian Women's Heart Health Alliance, and that's women across Canada, and there's 300 of us now, and there's researchers and women with lived experience and every type of healthcare discipline. We're all part of it. We're trying to figure out what's going on with heart disease in Canada. And 2 years ago, the women with lived experience that were on our Prairies Committee were coming and saying, it doesn't make sense. You know, I was a runner. I was a high-level athlete. And I started thinking, you know, we do know that when you hit menopause, which is around 52 years of age, and menopause is defined as 1 year without a period, a full year without a period. So that's menopause. I want to talk about that too, because we always say you're menopause or not, and there's this whole menopausal transition.
Absolutely.
We have to pay attention to that. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we did know that when you hit menopause, estrogen isn't just good for creating female characteristics in your, whether you get pregnant or not. Estrogen actually is really good for your blood vessels. And so it keeps them pliable and it prevents things from clogging in your system and it keeps your lipid level down. So when that's cut off, we know at menopause, when that's cut off, we end up having vascular issues. So high blood pressure and high lipid level. So I started thinking, you know, all these young women that are coming to us and saying, I was a high-level athlete. What's the thing that happens with high-level athletes or women that are really dieting is they lose their period. And we've always thought that's quite normal, right? You're a runner or you're Olympic. Right.
A gymnast trainer. Or whatever. Yeah.
Gymnast.
Yeah.
Gymnast's key, right? Like, yes. Because their diet is so low in fats, which we do need some good fats. So we started thinking, what if, you know, you lose your period for 2 years? It actually is doing some damage to your heart. So then when you come to get pregnant, which is, we call the first female stress test, really, because your blood volume increases by 2 times.
Hell of a stress test, let me tell you.
There's got to be an easier way.
I mean, just think about what it's doing to your vessels. Like, even when you're in labor, like, you know, I thought my head was going to blow off my body, you know? So what if you've 2 years or a year without your period and it's done this damage and you hit pregnancy and then you start having pregnancy problems, complications of pregnancy, we see, like high blood pressure or eclampsia. And then 10 years later, you show up with early heart disease. Mm. Well, it's because we've always said, normal to lose your period. But is it? Like, is that?
You know, I love that, that you're questioning these things. So it's so important, right?
Yeah. So that was, that link was found in the last 5 years.
Well, the link between the pregnancy complications and heart disease, early heart disease.
Wow.
Because it's so hard to say that's what's causing your early heart disease, right? But then we started to see, you know, all these women have something in common. Mm. They all had a complication of pregnancy and now they're showing up with early heart disease. And the heart disease isn't the plugged arteries heart disease. Women have different types of heart disease. One of the ones that's predominantly women is a thing called SCAD, or sudden coronary artery dissection. One of your arteries dissects, like it breaks apart.
Come on.
Oh my goodness.
And so if, and you cut your heart, you have a heart attack and you go into the hospital and you're, you know, it can happen after pregnancy as well. And so, because of the stress that's happening when you're pregnant. So SCAD is like 90% of the people who have SCAD are women. They're younger women, like women under 55. And it's the biggest cause for a heart attack for a woman under 55. So this person presents and says, oh my God, like my heart is killing me. Like it's hurting.
Yeah.
But they look like you guys. And you say, okay. Anxiety.
Well, that's the thing.
Right.
You
think, like, yeah, exactly. Yeah, are you stressed?
You're like, it can't be my lifestyle because I'm so healthy, or I exercise, or your diet's good. So you don't think it's those things.
Yeah.
You attribute it to all the
other
things.
You're telling yourself that, right?
Absolutely.
Like, but so the whole thing about what we're trying to do in the Canadian Women's Heart Health Alliance is just say, be aware of it.
Yeah.
You guys know this. You tell your friends. You say, hey, you had high blood pressure in pregnancy. You need to follow up with that.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you're going to get heart disease. Just manage your risk.
And be aware of the symptoms that would manifest, right?
Yeah.
Like, especially if you have been through a high-risk pregnancy or you had developed preeclampsia or whatever it was. Those are the people that really should be hyper aware of what the symptoms look like so that they can identify
and go
if
to
something
your,
is happening.
Go to your doctor.
Yeah.
Like, don't wait on it. Just go and say the things.
Yeah.
And help yourself.
And the other thing is we have to be really assertive too, because there's lots of clinicians that haven't heard of this. And you say, no, there's lots of evidence.
Don't make
Dr.
Call
Colleen. Norris said, they better know who you are.
And then we're going to read your bio. I'm just going to bring it with me to my doctor.
Yeah, exactly. So we touched on this very slightly before, but I'd love to dive into it deeper because I know this is an area of your expertise. You've done a lot of research that highlights both sex factors, which are biological constructs, and gender factors, which are social constructs. Can you tell us what you've uncovered about the effect of gender specifically on the causes of heart disease in women?
This was kind of like an aha moment for me. And again, this was like 15 years ago, but we did a study where we followed up on all the women. It was women and men who had an early heart attack, so below 55 years of age. And we looked at what we call gendered factors. And whenever I say gender, people automatically assume I'm talking about gender identity. And gender identity is one of those factors, you know, how you present to the world. Because that's going to cause all sorts of different stresses in your life. And, you know, when you're under stress, your cortisol runs high. And so it's doing stuff to your body. You may not even know it. So there's gender identity, but it's also gender relations. So what are your, one of the things we found out when I was doing PhD work is that women do better with a friend or a daughter or a sister as their primary relationship. Men do better if they're married.
Interesting. And also not shocking.
No, not at all, right?
Like, yeah, the ease you feel when you're with a group of your girlfriends is a very different situation.
Like one of my friends says, my boss. Yeah.
We've been saying for a long time that we just want to live in a commune full of our friends. Yeah. I feel like, you know, I think the marriage part serves men more than women, definitely.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that gender relations is something we would ask questions. Are you married? Do you have, and there's really good scales for that. Do you have someone that you can go to for emotional support? Do you have someone you can go to, you know, and those kind of questions. So we ask those. And then there's institutionalized gender, which is what are institutions like, how do they expect me to act? And, you know, women in the service industry and how they're treated and how that can have an influence on your outcomes. So that these gender factors, we asked all these questions. And what we discovered, we created what we called a gender index. And higher scores on the gender index were behaviors more likely to be female behaviors in our North American society. And so what we did is we looked and we compared the men and the women. And the men had, you know, these scales where they had really, most of them had low scores because they weren't doing these female-related behaviors. Some of them had female-related behaviors, like taking care of the kids. Right. Or being a house husband or whatever. So
no comment.
Then the women were, some of them had sort of more masculine behaviors, but of course it went. So then we divided it by men and women, and we discovered that people who had high gender scores or these behaviors more related to female behaviors were four times as likely to return with a second heart attack than people who had low gender index scores. So one of the scales in that gender index was, what's your stress level at home on a scale of 1 to 10? And it was the biggest predictor of this second heart attack.
Men are like zero. I go home to de-stress. It's just, I just eat the meal that's been prepared and throw my socks next to the hamper.
So that was telling us something, right? And these aren't physical things. These are generally, this isn't your biology. This is what
and
you're doing.
The emotional labor and stuff, that, like all the things we take on from that side, right? That's a big stress.
I said, you know, for me, when you ask what's my stress level at home or when I was you guys' age with young kids and stuff, it wasn't just balancing all these balls. And my husband was good. He said, I'll take him to the doctor. I'll do the teacher at parent. But I wanted to do that, right? I needed to be there. Yeah. So it's not that you can just say, okay, give your partner half the work you do. I needed to be there, you know? So the thing for me about that with the anxiety is that we can then turn to you and say, you scored really high on this. And we know that you now are predicted to have worse outcomes. And, you know, be blunt about it and say, I can't manage your stress for you. But let's talk about, or let's send you to a social worker or a psychologist, figure out how you're going to manage this.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. How do we manage the stress? How do we help ourselves? Or what can we tell our audience and our community of things they can do to lower that risk?
Yeah. And I actually was just at a conference in London, and one of the presenters was a GP from outside of London, and she had this great cake analogy and all the pieces of the cake. And she said, I probably shouldn't use cake, you know, because it's to do with heart disease. But but each piece of cake was like your nutrition or your diet or your sleeping. Mm-hmm. And she had parts of that. And they were so practical things about, I said I was going to talk to you about the menopausal transition.
Yeah, and that's next. We can.
That's my latest thing. I've just written a paper, Menopausal Transition and Women's Heart Disease, and it's two sides of the same coin, because nobody in the heart industry or in cardiology is looking at where are you at in that menopausal transition. And it's such a big part of us. It's like puberty, pregnancy, menopausal transition. Yeah. So we figured out all about puberty, and we know how to get our girls ready and what to expect, and the same thing with pregnancy. Not a thing done. Either you're at menopause or you're not.
Right.
But there's so much that happens. And what made me think about it with this sleep thing is that it's just assumed when you're in perimenopause that you're not going to sleep for 4 years.
Right.
So I'm driving along listening to some scientists talk about sleep deprivation is directly related to Alzheimer's disease. And Alzheimer's disease is 2/3 of the people who get it are women. And I'm thinking, oh my God, it's because people aren't sleeping during perimenopause, yeah, right?
I can attest to that.
It does something to your system.
Yeah.
And we keep saying, this is normal. No, it's not normal, right? It's just like not having your period for 2 years.
Yeah.
But I think it's because it's women's health. It's normal.
Yeah. And we're kind of expected to just live with it, just like we have with our periods and everything else. Like, get on with your day. Every commercial has taught us that since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're not used to stopping and saying, you know, I need to help myself.
And it's easier to say that's normal than to admit we've really failed women in terms of researching their bodies for the last couple hundred years. Like, we're only just starting to do that.
Oh, totally.
I'm sure you're fine. Don't worry. Like, that just rolls off the tongue a little nicer than, I'm sorry, we failed you.
Well, also, you know, the assumption was always, this was work we did a while ago, but the assumption is always that when you're looking at clinical trials, you know, testing medications for heart disease and stuff, that it's half men and women. Well, we know it's not. At the most in the cardiovascular trials, they might have 30% in those trials that are telling us what drugs we're going to use to treat you for all this.
Yeah.
And so I was called the sex and gender champion on one of the clinical practice guidelines committees. And they were determining what the care is across Canada for anybody who has what's called a ST elevation MI. So STEMI is what they call it. But it's just what shows on your ECG, the type of myocardial infarction you've had. And I looked at the 800 trials that were used for to identify, you know, what treatments we're going to use. And they look and say, this is a good clinical trial, and they followed all the rules. And so this, we can accept these outcomes. And there was some trials in there that had no women in them that were used for these guidelines, right? And so then it comes back to us
excluded.
Women don't participate in trials. They say, that's BS. It's not because they don't want to. We have to figure out a way to get women involved in research, but that's working with their lifestyle. And I have a really good example of this. I was shadowing at a preeclampsia clinic. So women who had eclampsia, which high blood pressure and all sorts of issues with your proteins, in pregnancy. And in the hospital, they were asked, would you like to participate in a clinical trial about your follow-up? And they all agreed, yes, we'd love to. And it was a really great clinical trial. And you went into the clinic after you had your baby, and it had a dietitian, it had a nurse practitioner, it had a physician, it had rehab med. You know, we say you have to do 150 hours of exercise a week or something, you know, to a new mom. Like, that's
right.
Are you crazy? So working with you, what can you do? You know, how do you do that? So really great trial. And I'm sitting there, and the biggest issue they have is no showroom. And while I'm sitting there, the phone rings, and it's the woman that we're waiting for. And she says, pardon my French, I've been driving around this effing parking lot for 2 hours. You can hear the baby screaming in the back.
God. There's your stress level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, like, we're running a trial in a major urban hospital. Like, how are they going to get here and get in?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So going to the community to do your trial. So we just have to rethink how we can get women involved in clinical trials.
And women of all ages, right? Like, and your research is so focused on the stages of women's lives. So just to have, like, okay, let's meet our female quota. Here's like 10, 25-year-old women that are going to come in isn't going to cut it. You need somebody that represents each stage in a woman's lifespan, ideally, right? Like, that's where you get the equity there.
Yeah. And that, you know, I almost get booed when I say this, but like, we need to stop putting men and women in the same trial. We need to just be doing women's research, bottom line, right? Because, you know, if you can tell me something we haven't researched on men, please, you know, I'm happy to hear about it. But the bottom line is, we need to catch up. And the other thing is, when you have women and men, you always compare the outcomes between women and men, and the men are the gold standard. And I'm saying, no, because we have all these different life stages, women need to be the gold standard is comparison to women in your life stage, right? Like, where you're at. So comparing perimenopausal women to perimenopausal women, that's what we need to do.
Yeah,
because if we compare them to menopausal women, it's like comparing apples and oranges.
It's like different species. Like, yeah. It's not even a question.
Yeah. We answered our questions on
you
the pregnancy effects and the menopause.
You answered so many questions that we didn't even ask because you're just so prepared.
Which is amazing. We're curious, too, about the effect that COVID has had on women's specific heart health issues. Like people that have had COVID, which is so many of us now. Is there stuff that we need to be aware of or looking out for in the future? Like what has there been any correlation shown? Has there not been enough time?
I think they're just starting to come out about that. And it's really interesting you asked me because yesterday I used Twitter for science and I you get all sorts of manuscripts out. And they came out with a manuscript that identified that there is absolutely an association between the COVID virus itself sitting in our vasculature and actually causing blockages. So people who are already at risk or have heart disease already, it's worse for them.
Right.
Because of the COVID virus. But they didn't tell us, they had women in it, but it just said, this is what, and I said, what about the women? You know, like, that's what I tweeted. Like, can we see the results?
Right. That should be the literal headline for all of this is what about the women?
What about the women, right? And so we do know there were, right from the beginning, women who got COVID actually did better than the men and they got sicker, but they did better than the men. And it has to do with the fact that we have two X chromosomes, men have XY, and the immune system is on our X chromosome. So if one isn't working, the other one can kick in. So, So we actually,
look at us.
we mount a stronger immune response. So that's why we get sicker, right? Although our body's really going into overdrive to fight these things. So we do know that. We know from the get-go that there are differences between the way women experience COVID and the way men experience COVID.
Right.
But it's going to be another push to say, can we see the results?
Yeah. So we just need to advocate for women's specific research surrounding the effect of COVID.
But like Colleen said, you have to be assertive and you have to ask for those things and you have to push.
I do it every manuscript I read. I'll say, what about the women? You know?
Yeah.
And we should be. They'll often say in the scientific literature, well, we didn't have enough women to have statistical power to say that the outcomes are like this. And my response is, I don't care. It doesn't have to be statistically significant. Yeah. Just tell me about it. And the reason for that is I looked at one trial where the outcome was bleeding or something like that. And the men, whatever the drug was, it stopped the bleeding in the men. The women had way more bleeding. But because they didn't have enough women, they said, well, it's not statistically significant, so we can't say anything.
That's just so lazy, though. And I feel like if it was the other way around and we were getting tested and the men were getting left behind, there would be like an uproar.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Of course.
Totally. I remember
when the majority of the population.
I remember when my sister had breast cancer and she's, you know, she's going through these mammograms and she says, men for all of their cancers have blood tests. And she says, do you think if a man had to have his scrotum squeezed down to a pancake, they wouldn't have developed something pretty damn quick?
Totally.
100%.
Or if they had their periods, they'd be getting a week off for sure.
Yes.
We're just like, go to school, go to work.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah, you're right. That thing would be like in a historical museum.
And everything would be free.
Yes.
Like everything you need.
Yes.
Okay, so how did we get to a point where heart disease and stroke are the leading cause of death for women? What needs to change?
Premature death.
Yes. What needs to change institutionally to improve outcomes where women's health is concerned?
Other than more women in the research trials.
Yeah, no, that's a good start. And awareness.
What about the women?
Yes.
It's
awareness.
It's lay people talking about it. One of the studies we did was that I looked at women in Alberta, and this is just Alberta I'm talking about. And we looked at women who went to an emergency department and then were discharged home and then came back with a heart attack within 30 days. There are 300 women a year. Some of those women had been to the emergency department up to 15 times before.
This is infuriating.
Yeah.
Up to 15 times.
to the emergency department, discharged home with it's your head, it's your GI, it's then came
you're hysterical. And, let's give you a hysterectomy.
You'll be fine.
So we presented those results, and especially to clinicians. But in all fairness, you know, I was reading about this and trying to say, how do we get clinicians to get rid of their bias when they see a woman like you walking and saying something's wrong with my heart, right?
Right.
So I was looking through it, and it's in the, it's actually in the employment literature, because they're saying, you know, the minute someone walks in, whether you're going to hire them or not, just by looking at them, right? And one of the most interesting studies that they talk about in all of this is the New York Philharmonic, and women couldn't get on that orchestra if their life depended on it. So they started these behind the screen auditions. So you can't see if it's a woman or a man you're listening to. 50-50 now, right? So, but we can't put screens in front of doctors. So I just think it's really raising awareness that don't be fooled by what's sitting in front of you, right? Just as long as you pay attention to it. And that's all the bias literature says. You know, when you do those studies through Harvard to figure out if you're biased against obese people or, you know, different ethnicities and stuff, you answer questions and it's a big surprise. Like, I didn't even realize I was biased. Mm-hmm. Like that. But once you've made that connection, then you start saying, I got to pay attention. So instead of when these women walk in and you say, I'm guessing their age is 35 to 45, perimenopause, stop and say, and then the women are saying, this isn't perimenopause. I know what perimenopause is. And start having those conversations with your clinician or the emergency doctor. Like, you know, it's not saying, I'm not leaving here until you do something. It's saying, look, I'm really concerned. This is what it could be. I did have this, you know, pregnancy complication, and this is what's going on. And I really wanted to investigate.
Well, and it's like the more you know, right? And this is why we're raising awareness too, because the women that can listen to this podcast then go to their doctor's office. And if they're disregarded for things like that, they can say, no, actually, I'd really like you to take a look at this.
Yeah.
It gives them a little leg to stand on.
Yeah. And there's lots of data out there. Like go Canadian Women's Heart Health Alliance, the website.
Yeah.
Incredible amounts of resources and data and stuff you can do.
Okay, good. I hope people that are curious actually go to that website and take a look. So before we go, we have a massive community, mostly of moms, mostly women, age 25 to 45. That's kind of our wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So other than the stuff that we've spoken about already about the pregnancy issues, what do women in that demographic need to know about heart health that could help them avoid a catastrophe in the future?
So like you said, what you need to know what your risks are. And actually, if you go on like the Canadian Women's Heart Health Alliance, you can identify these risks. It's not just hearing them. But the other thing is obviously healthy lifestyle. But the biggest message that I want women that age to take is that it's just like the airplane that's saying, airplane message, put your oxygen mask on first. Mm-hmm. You are of no value to your loved ones if you have a heart attack or a stroke. It changes your life. You will not be able to do stuff with your kids that you wanted to do. So you really have to get the message that I have to take care of myself. If you are feeling incredible fatigue and you're short of breath and these things are going on, you have to take care of that because no one else will.
And that's hard for women sometimes to put ourselves first.
Totally hard.
Just to get that into your head, put yourself first. And there's this whole thing about self-love and self-care and all this stuff. But it is really hard for women to disengage with everything that they're obligated to do and all their responsibilities and things like that.
Yeah.
And they don't put themselves first. A lot of the times they put themselves last, actually. They're at the bottom of that. But we always say, don't pour from an empty cup. Which is the same message is you have to fill yourself up first. And that's the only way you're going to be of value to anyone else.
Well, and
or yourself.
Or yourself.
Like, screw everybody else.
Fuck those kids.
You also need to be able to like live a full, enjoyable life. And so, you have to just be aware of what you're doing and the effects of what you're doing can have on your health. Such a stressful thing to think about. And the gender piece is so important because this is so women specific. Like everything that we just said in the last 2 minutes about how we don't put ourselves first and we have so much else going. Like, that's completely gendered. And that is totally a social construct that's been really levied on us.
Yeah, we need to stop that shit.
Yeah.
Well, and if you look at countries like Sweden and Norway, where they have better pregnancy, post-pregnancy, you know, laws and stuff.
Right.
You have the men have to take it, the women have to take it. It actually starts to engender those behaviors, right? Like, it isn't just me taking care of the baby.
Well, and then how you're taken care of. I mean, we're still pretty lucky here with our mat leave and stuff. When I think of the women in the U.S., like, it breaks our heart that they get like 6 weeks after they give birth and they're sent back to work, and their stress levels are crazy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. That would be really interesting to see the different outcomes of women in Canada versus
with
the U.S.
mat leaves and stuff and how you're taken care of.
Because like, society does need to take care of people at the end of the day.
Yeah, I don't think our neighbors down south are overly concerned about that.
No, doesn't seem so.
No.
No, exactly. Well, Dr. Norris, thank you so much for taking the time to sit with us and discuss all of this today. It was such a valuable conversation. I hope everybody takes all this information and runs with it.
Take it to heart.
Yes.
Take it to heart. Good one, babe. Yeah. Well, I'll have to do that for our next February 13th day. Take it to heart.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, good. You can credit Alex from the Rebel Mama.
And we'll help promote it.
Yes, exactly. And we'll help promote it. If people are looking to keep up to date with your latest findings, where can they follow you online? Twitter?
Yeah, Twitter for sure. Twitter for sure. Because we have,
What's your Twitter handle?
What's your handle?
At Women's Hearts 2, all one word. So WOMESHEART2.
Okay. We will link that in the show notes after this as well. And we also recommend that everybody follow WHC Canada on Instagram and check into www.whcc.ca often to stay informed as new research comes to light from their incredible network of doctors and clinicians.
If you like what you heard today, there's more coming. Thanks to our amazing partners at WHCC, we're hosting a total of 3 researchers this season, so make sure to follow or subscribe so you don't miss one. As always, we'd love for you to like, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen, and feel free to share it with a friend who you think would benefit from it, aka share it with all your women friends, please.
This podcast was produced by Space Monkey inside the Soda Studio. The song you're listening to is called Name a Number off the debut album Unrequited by Roshan. Stream it now on Apple Music.